The Big Weekend of Books
on Radio National.
G'day, I'm Jonathan Green. I present Blueprint on Radio National. You're about to hear a conversation with author Bruce Pascoe, the man who wrote Dark Emu. And I've got to say, this is a conversation I've been looking forward to. There are not many books that change the way people think, that actually shift ideas. In this case, shift ideas on the very notion of Australia and its history. Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu is one of those books. And for most non-Indigenous readers, it's a challenge to hardwired notions of how people lived in this place for over 60 millennia. 60,000 years, maybe more. And in that lies a blunt challenge to how we live now in this place as the blend of cultures we see around us 231 years after the First Fleet. Bruce Pascoe, the author, he's in his early 70s now. He continues to be a prolific writer of essays, of fiction, short fiction, young adult fiction. He's a former teacher. He's a farmer. He's a passionate believer in the promise of ancient agricultural methods as we confront shifts in climate, that the sudden disturbance of ecological systems. Bruce, hello.
How you going, Jonathan?
I'm good. Just that idea of disturbed ecology this past summer, what an extraordinary time for that. The fires were remarkable and in your neck of the woods.
Yeah. Mallacoota was severely impacted, and I was talking to a few of the survivors at the weekend. Only one person died in this district, but everyone experienced trauma of one kind or another, and we're still reviewing it. Every time we meet. It's almost impossible not to talk about those days, the fires here on the river. It was the kind of thing you couldn't avoid. You just had to keep going. And I think a lot of us now are starting to feel the pinch of that hyper-alertness during that time where we couldn't rest, we barely slept, and having to accommodate that new look at life. It really changed a lot of people's attitudes, and I was really fortunate. I had good neighbours. We all helped each other. We all kept our houses. We lost plenty of things, but we kept our houses. So our worldview hasn't been as dramatically altered as those who lost everything.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of people like my cousin who lost all his tools, all his grandfather's artifacts. I'm thinking of a mate of mine who was a plumber and lost all his tools and has to start his life again as a result. And, you know, that didn't happen here, you know, apart from sheds and fences and bits of infrastructure, you know, our life continues. But for others, you start again. I'm thinking of a pair of 80-plus-year-olds who lost a house. It's so sapping of energy, and when you're 80, it must be hard to find that energy. So it's changed a lot of lives here, but it's also sharpened our opinion of how we have to look after the earth.
What's that, as you bump into other people, that extraordinary shared experience, there must be sort of a deep knowledge between you all now. There's something inside you, all of you, that has shifted.
Yeah, there are deep bonds. I got to know people who I'd known most of my life, three quarters of my life, and I thought I knew them really well as a result of 50 years of knowledge. But in fact, we know a lot more about each other now, and we know the people that we can depend on. You know, we did depend on them. We needed them very badly. We needed their energy, their courage, and that's not something you forget very, very easily. It's always there. You acknowledge them with a glance, not always a word, but it's there between you, what you saw.
This is, of course, being listened to by people around the country. Just take us to Mallacoota. I know your latest collection of writing, Salt, is dedicated to the three rivers of Mallacoota. Just talk to us about that place.
In fact, most of my writing is about Mallacoota. If you look at my novels and poems, a great proportion of it is Mallacoota. I came here in 1969 with my uncle, who told me that country was very special to our family. And even when I was away from it, I lived in the Otways for 20 wonderful years in that wonderful country, but I dreamt of Mallacoota. And fortunately, I was able to come back here in 2002, and I've renewed my acquaintance with this wonderful country. The lake system at Mallacoota is fed from the ocean by salt water. It abounds in birds and fish, insects and forest, and also, it has an incredible Aboriginal presence here. There were so many massacres around Mallacoota that I can only name half a dozen people in the district who have identified as Aboriginal. Of course, there are dozens more who are Aboriginal but don't identify with it. And who is to blame them? People in my own family have done that. But I just think it's a sadness for me because of social pressure, and that's what it is. You don't need to think about it very deeply to understand what that social pressure is and how powerful local opinion is to how you want to identify. But just think of America right now. Mm. And the disdain with which the lives of black people are held, and whether or not their opinions are credited with being human. And you get a feeling for what it's like for many people to acknowledge all aspects of their birth. But for me, I've been incredibly fortunate. I grew up with incredibly strong women. You know, my father was a wonderful man. My uncles were wonderful men. But it was the women who ran those families. And so I inherited an idea of the strength of people and their honour and their love. So for me to put up with hardship was just part of the family tradition. It was just what you did. My mother was blind, deaf and epileptic and never had a bad word to say about being alive. She was a wonderful person and she taught me about endurance and love. Once you accept that love and believe in its intense importance, you'll never be without it. It'll cause you problems. You'll have your disappointments, but I just need to think of what my mother endured, and everything else is bloody easy.
Because you weren't a rich family growing up. I mean, your dad worked hard, but he was not a man with a gift for managing money.
No, my father was a really good builder, but he was a terrible business person. And so periodically we were without a home and money. But as a kid, I wasn't aware of it. You know, our cars kept on getting worse. I remember my dad selling quite a good car to buy a green FX Holden Ute, which had been resprayed a number of times and not very well. And I was delighted because the taillight of an FX Holden is a beautiful pink colour. You don't see them very often now, but it was a glorious colour, and I just thought that car was the best thing I'd ever seen. And but for my father, it was a total humiliation, and I didn't understand that until later on. But he didn't understand greed, my father. He just didn't understand that people were out to take him down. So everyone else's craven instinct was a complete mystery to him. And so he got ripped off dozens of times. So by the time I was about 12, I was determined that I would always have a house. And so by the time I was 23, 24, I'd paid a deposit on my own house. And I say to young people now, you know, perhaps it's part of my own paranoia, but I say to young Aboriginal people, you know, stop smoking, save your money, put a deposit on a bloody house, particularly at this time, because, you know, you'll always have something and no one can kick you out. And I think it's really important for people to have a solid base. You know, maybe it's a terrible conservatism in some people's minds, but for me, it's the basis of my life. I want to be to sit on my own veranda and have a cup of tea and be able to do that 10 years' time and for no one to tell me it's not mine.
It's a tremendous and grounding feeling. Growing up in that 50s Melbourne, and as you sketch there, it's a tough world. You would eventually decide to make your way in letters, in writing, in books. Hmm. But as a young bloke, what did you read?
You know, I read the William books, you know, because my education sort of lent itself towards old England. And it wasn't until years later I realised how English they were and how different from my own culture. But then I started to read Jack London. You know, it's terrible to think how badly I think of the Americans, but then how highly I think of their writers and their musicians. There's, you know, this awful divide in America at the moment is what I noticed as a young person, that the glorious writing, the glorious music, you know, and I'm thinking of Irving Berlin and people like that, but also William Faulkner, Jack London, Carson McCullers, you know, just superb writing, superb emotion, you know, really refined emotion, and loving the ideas that were expressed so tenderly by all those people. And so that, you know, and Dylan Thomas, of course, you know, all of those things I was reading from the age of about 14 or 15, and that though William Faulkner influenced me enormously, Dylan Thomas did too, obviously, but I think it was Faulkner more than anyone. Christopher Brennan also had a big impact. You know, I suppose there was always a tendency in literature students to feel a bit maudlin, and Christopher Brennan fed that very easily. I was a voracious reader. My grandmother's only bought me books, you know. Everyone else got a cricket bat or a bloody radio for Christmas. And I got books from both grandmothers. And even then, they were aware that that would keep me happy and out of the way for most of the summer months. And yet I played sport, you know. I was the Australian boy. I'm still playing sport. I love it, but I love books more. I love writing more than books. I'm a storyteller, and in the Aboriginal community, I'm seen as that, as the storyteller. And really, really good people have kept encouraging me from within the Aboriginal community to tell their stories. Sometimes I say, you're not allowed to tell this one. I'll tell it to you, but you're not allowed to retell it. But most of the time they say, tell that story.
Tell those stories about our life so that people will understand us and understand their country. So I'll never run out of stories, you know. I don't believe in writer's block because there's just too much pressure on me. And I put the pressure on myself because I love the pen and I can tolerate the keyboard. And I'm always telling stories because where I live, I see story every day, you know. I've got – today there are six Yuin men working on the farm here, and at lunchtime we sit around and we talk culture. We don't talk football. We talk culture. I don't think I go through a lunchtime without being surprised and thinking to myself, there's another one I've got to tell. You know, it's just, I feel like it's a very rich life.
On Radio National's big weekend of books, you're listening to author Bruce Pascoe. I'm Jonathan Green. Bruce, when did you work out you could tell stories? When did you work out you had a gift for setting down words?
I didn't enjoy school very much, but at Mornington State School a long time ago, there was a lovely lady there who always encouraged, I think she encouraged everyone, but I revelled in her warmth and her regard. And one day she read something I'd written, and she said, come down to the principal's office with me.
I'd written something that had upset her. So when I got to the principal's office with her, she made me read out what I had written to him. And I realised that they thought it was good. In fact, it was incredibly English, you know, because of the stuff we'd been reading. I was describing an oak door. Fancy an Australian talking about an oak door, but that's what I wrote about, and it must have resembled an oak door pretty well because they were impressed. And it was, I'll never forget the moment, because they were telling me that I was a storyteller. What I wanted to tell them years later was no good storyteller in Australia should be talking about oak doors.
Back in 1988, you put out a novel called Fox. In that, the character Fox is a fugitive looking for his Aboriginal identity, his sense of home. Is that a bit of your story there?
Yeah, it is. I don't write about myself very much. I hear stories, so I retell the stories I hear, but very little of my own personal life is in those stories. I'm so fascinated by other people. I find other people's lives extraordinary. In fact, I don't think I meet a person whose life doesn't intrigue me. When you get down to it, you start talking to people about the things that have moved them and changed them, and everything is fascinating. So there's plenty of stories to tell, but most of my novels and poems and stories are about Mallacoota and that search for identity, which I was going through. I've heard those stories from so many other people that, you know, I can tell my story through their stories because I can understand the difficulty. And so I just, I tell a life story. I, I tell the stories that have intrigued me, and they reflect my own, but they're not me. You know, Fox, the character Fox turns up one way or another in almost every novel I've ever written. And Fox is the name of a real man that stayed at my farm for a few weeks. He was in a bit of trouble, it seems.
He needed a feed, so I gave him a meal, and he told me stories. And it was only later on I realised that he was in trouble with the law. He'd used my name to eventually he used my name to get a car from Eden and drove off and didn't pay, and so the coppers were looking for me, thinking I'd taken off. But I was a school teacher at the time, so I had a good alibi, and it just seemed that this young man was in desperate straits and he was scamming in his life. So a lot of the stories that he told me have been retold in my novels, and it's about desperation, about what happens when you find yourself at the bottom of the pile and how you might make a decision to change that. But if that decision is against the law, then you'll be running for the rest of your life. And that's what that young man was doing. He was running, constantly running away. And it's a shame. He was a decent person.
You seem a lot in early life, you know, observations of Aboriginality. When did that sort of ping to you? When did you have a sense about that is part of my character, that is part of myself?
I had an extraordinary response to country, but that could be the case for any person, really. I was at Mornington and my uncle was talking to me about the family background, and I met a lady down there, an Aboriginal woman, and one day when she was really cross with me, you know, she told me what's for and said that I shouldn't be so bloody uppity because I was as black as she was. And I was stunned by that. You know, I then had to assimilate that with my uncle's stories. But it wasn't until I was about 17, I suppose, and I was driving trucks illegally for my uncle. He was a truck driver. And I started to ask him about those things, and he was saying how in his family Aboriginality was a really fraught issue. I mentioned it to his mum, and she never spoke to me again, even though we had been really close. I used to stay there frequently in that house, but she never spoke to me again when I mentioned Aboriginality. And I've met people in my family since then.
Some people have hold down that knowledge so tightly that they don't seem to be able to let it out at all. So, but then, you know, 17, I was playing football and in love with girls frequently and, you know, totally distracted until my own daughter asked me when she was 5 about some photographs in the family album, and I couldn't explain them at all. And I couldn't even explain why those photographs hadn't sparked a question in my own mind. They had sparked questions, but I'd never asked them. And, you know, so from that point on, I just thought it was ridiculous that I wouldn't be pursuing that knowledge. And I was very, very fortunate to be living at Apollo Bay at the time, and so I was meeting Aboriginal people all the time, and, you know, they were just infusing me with stories. Some of the great people in Aboriginal Victoria were my guides, and it was just a fluke that I happened to be living where I was living, and those people were so generous, you know,
I always think of the good fortune I've had in my life, and that was one of those times when those people just infused me with story.
Been on that that track, and as recently as last weekend, I was talking law with Ewan Lawmen and Ewan Lawwomen, just a small group of us, you know, legally, COVID-wise, you'd have to say. And we were making decisions about how we would instruct our young people, which for me were just earth-shattering. The importance of them was earth-shattering.
You're listening to Bruce Pascoe, author of, yes, of course, Dark Emu. On Radio National's Big Weekend of Books, I'm Jonathan Green. Bruce, I want to take you back to, again, we began our chat talking about the summer and the fires and that extraordinary devastating time in your community. You're working as a CFA volunteer. You went and fought fires in New South Wales as well. And in the midst of all that, there's a terrible culture war kerfuffle going on about your identity.
I didn't fight fires in New South Wales. I'm on the border of Vic in New South Wales, so I mean, I can actually swim into New South Wales, but, you know, I was basically working only with the CFA in fires on this side of the border, but that's only a small point. You know, and the culture wars had been going on since November or October. I can't remember when it started. And that deeply affected me. It was incredibly painful, and painful for my family too. All of whom were fantastic, actually. I felt sorry for my kids and my grandkids, for that matter. But my kids were wonderful, as I expected they would be. It wasn't a surprise, but it was a relief. But the sad thing was that it all began with a website called Dark Emu Exposed, you know, where it was supposed to show that Dark Emu was a fabrication, that it had was lying about the history of Australia, et cetera, et cetera. And so the motivation was about trying to prevent this story of chemical-free agriculture being taken up by Australians. It seems as bald as that.
It was an incredibly painful time, and it just went on and on and on. And it was the kind of tactics which are meant to sap your morale, and it worked. But once again, I was surrounded by Aboriginal men and women who stood by me. Only recently I was stopped in the street by a very senior Aboriginal man who grabbed me by the shoulders and shook me and said, if you stop doing what you're doing, I'm going to bundy you. Bundy means belt you up. I had other people more or less say the same thing. You keep telling that story. You know, that's what we want you to do. Another man, on a terrible day for me, when, you know, I'd been, you know, being hounded by the press about these issues, and during the middle of that day, once again, a very senior Aboriginal man, very famous man actually, rang me up and said, look, we know who your family is. You know, I should have rung you before, maybe. And, you know, I thought, yeah, you bloody should have. But he said, we know your family. You know, I boxed in the tents with your family. And that moment told me that I was free, that
they could make every attempt to undermine me and unsettle me and strip away the foundations of my life. But if my own people were going to refuse to accept that, then I was free. And so from that moment on, it really didn't matter what was going to happen. And then, of course, the fires occurred and, you know, I just couldn't think about it anymore. It was still going on. People have told me later that it was still going on. But for me, it was over because I had a much more pressing priority. And we were so dependent upon each other down here that you'd never had a moment to think about anything but them or your own family. So in a way, it was a hell of a relief. Even though the fires were horrible, it was an extraordinary way to live.
Yes.
It felt more like war than normal life. But it did relieve me. And we only just came out of that, and then COVID had us isolated here. But really, our isolation, we were already isolated. I mean, the farm where I live, you can't get much more isolated in Victoria. And so we were able to continue working here. We lost all our crop. We had another crop. And we could see from the moment it started to grow, this wonderful Australian perennial grass, we could see that we would have another crop. And we harvested that in April, May, and we're still processing it into flour. But that was like a gift for us because we were desolate. Once we'd lost that crop, which was going to be part of our answer to the degradation of Australian farming land, we were going to be able to propose a different model. And then our kangaroo grass got burnt and we thought, there goes 12 months hard work, because we'd worked very hard on that crop. But then this other one came, was like Mother Earth said, you know, what are you worried about, you people? Here, look at this. And she was wonderful and gave us that crop, a grass we had never harvested it before. And I remember watching the quad bike going around towing the harvester, and, you know, it struck me, the man driving that quad bike comes from the very heart of the Yuin Nation. You know, his family name is the name of mountains and rivers and ranges and story. It couldn't have been a better person to be running the harvester at that time. And on reflection that night, I thought how fortunate I had been to be in that position and to watch that happening and to think, this is going to change things in the country. This is going to help repair and make our farms sustainable and regenerative and all those lovely words. But in fact, those lovely words are accompanied by an enormous amount of labour. But it's going to happen. Australians are already turning to perennial grasses. I hope they now turn to perennial vegetables. So that we can continue to put carbon back into the soil. That's what we're doing. At some stage, an Australian government is going to pay people to grow perennial foods so that we can restore the earth. It probably won't be this government, but a government is going to do it. And if we can start making a difference to how we use the earth and how we can protect the earth as our home rather than as a mine, we'll make a big difference. We'll make a big difference to the earth, our own health, but also how we see ourselves as a nation.
How we see ourselves as a nation is the thing that you're having an impact on. Your book, Dark Emu, out in 2014, 800 copies in its first print run. It's now sold over 100,000. That says something about the thirst amongst non-Indigenous Australians for an understanding of this place.
Yeah, it sold over 200,000 copies.
Sorry to underestimate.
Well, booksellers were ringing me saying people are coming in buying 10 copies at once and giving them away to, as Christmas presents. It was an incredible response to the conservative view of Australia. Australians were saying, we don't believe that crap anymore. You know, that was our, you know, our milk and bread as we grew up as kids, but we don't believe it anymore. We're not going to accept it anymore. I think Australia will be a different place. If Dark Emu has had a role in that, it's only because of my search for my family made me relearn the entire history of the country. It forced it on me. It wasn't my choice. It wasn't a matter of brilliance. It was a matter of necessity. And I was just a vehicle for it, you know, and people might think that that's, you know, a too modest response or something. I'm searching for the word to describe that, but I'm not trying to be ultra modest. I'm trying to tell you the truth that without the pressure on me from older Aboriginal people to really learn the history of the country, I wouldn't have gone there. They forced me to do it. They forced me into the libraries. They forced me to learn the horrible history of Australia. It wasn't easy, but I was put in that position, and my grandmother had prepared me for it. So those, you know, those fortuitous events in your life just put you in that position, and then the old people say, now go and learn the history of the country and tell it. All of those things combined, it could have been any number of people to have done that. It's just that the accidents of my life put me in that position.
And other people have too, of course. I mean, Bill Gammage, Rupert Gerritsen, the people working in this space. It's a story that was itching to be told. It's amazing, Bruce, that sort of the arc of your life from that, that the primary school boy writing about the oak door, that sort of that steeped in Englishness, to then become what you are in your 70s as someone looking at how to rehabilitate this country, how to give those ideas of what we might do to use Indigenous knowledge to help us in a future. That's an amazing life story.
Yeah, it is. And but I think of Rupert Gerritsen's life too, you know, a man who tried to blow up the American embassy in Perth as during the Vietnam War, was the person I relied on most in telling Dark Emu. It should have been Rupert who was getting this acclaim. But
tell us about his work, yeah.
Well, Rupert was writing this this history, which was causing other historians and archaeologists to attack him with a vehemence, which I thought was disgusting. And I only came to Rupert's books and work after searching for, you know, my original search was Australian grain harvests, thinking that it would take me to the original grain harvest, early Australian grain harvest, what I put in. And, of course, there was virtually nothing there to help me except Bill Gammage and a number of other Australian archaeologists, Sylvia Hammond being another one, and of course, Rupert Gerritsen. And, you know, I learnt about Rupert's life story, and it just seemed such an unlikely story, and yet here he was, a man under siege himself, telling a story that nobody believed. And so I relied heavily on him and Gammage and Hallam and all of those people. You'll see the names in the back of Dark Emu because I revere them. They were able to provide me with the knowledge that sparked my search and sparked this idea that we had been sold a pup in our history. Hmm. And the rest of it then was just a slog in the library. And if you're a book person, that's not hard work at all. I remember I'm so attached to so many libraries and so many librarians who got excited too. And didn't understand where I was going with it, but would bring me rare books, some of them with uncut pages. And they helped me follow this bent, but it was all inspired by, some other heroes, and started by Aboriginal people who couldn't read or write. That's the incredible thing. Aboriginal story, people like to call it an oral tradition.
Yeah.
Well, it is, but those people could read and write, but they could read and write the country. They couldn't read and write English. And their ability as storytellers and as philosophers and as part of the intelligentsia has been my inspiration always. And, I just think I've been very fortunate.
What does Australia look like when post-colonial Australia accepts the truth of its history? What does it become?
I think it becomes a very busy country. There is so much for us to do. This last summer should have told us that we're in strife. The whole of the eastern seaboard was alight. And driving to Berry the other day, I drove through a third of it and it was fire the whole way. Mm. Some beautiful towns destroyed. And, I hear the stories of those people on the radio. And it's heartbreaking. But here's our chance now. Here's our chance to accept our history and to accept the management of the country that Aboriginal people undertook. To really understand the real condition of Australia, the driest continent on earth, and how to manage it. And Aboriginal people didn't talk about drought. They talked about crops, the right crops, Australian crops, not crops from the Fertile Crescent of the Mediterranean, Australian crops, because these are the crops that were domesticated by Aboriginal people.
And the yield per acre is tiny compared to that of those exotic crops. But then you don't have to plough. You don't have to use chemicals. You don't have to use fertilizer. And your tractor hours are rendered 25% of what you would normally be doing. So this is Australia's opportunity to engage with the country in a different way and to protect our soil. Some areas of Australia have lost 13 metres of topsoil. It's common for people to have lost 2 metres of topsoil. Any farmer who thinks it's okay to lose 2 metres of topsoil shouldn't really be allowed to drive a tractor. I drove through Brewarrina south to southern New South Wales just before the fires, and there was a massive dust storm there. I drove through 100 kilometres of dust in the air because people were ploughing the land for cotton. That's intolerable. You shouldn't be allowed to call yourself a farmer if you're allowing the topsoil to blow away. And I think this will make a massive change in the way Australians manage the land if we start protecting the soil, if we start valuing our topsoil, if we start valuing our trees, if we start valuing Australian plants. All this will make a huge difference to Australia, and I think it will begin to look a lot different than it does today.
the forest that, you know, even my own botanical friends like to call virgin forest is not a virgin forest at all. It's all been logged sometimes several times. And that's what caused the fire. These forests that we have now, the trees are too close together. The plantations of pine and eucalypt around this country here at Mallacoota were almost designed to become wildfire. And that's what happened on January the 31st. This forest here burnt so hot that it was like snow had fallen on the ground. And that's because the trees are cheek by jowl. Their canopies touch. As soon as they got hot enough, the forest exploded, not individual trees, the forest exploded. And we have to learn to farm and forest this country differently. The old Australian Aboriginal people had 10 or 12 trees to the acre on average. And just before the fires, when we knew the fire was coming, I counted an acre of New South Wales forestry, and there were 300 plus trees to an acre. It couldn't help but burn because all the trash that they had been dropping on the ground was still there. It was a, you know, a tinderbox, the old cliche about Australian fire, but it wasn't like that before. You can look into the soil here. We had a soil expert here, and we dug down a metre and a half and we looked at the soil profile. 200 years ago and below, you could see really mild fires had been burning. They were grassland fires. People had been deliberately burning the grassland to promote the grassland. And then after 200 years, you get these huge chunks of charcoal in the soil profile because that's wildfire. That's trees falling down and depositing these pellets of charcoal in the soil. A complete change of 200 years ago. We have to forget about the three-year periods of each government and think in terms of 70 years. Australians have to tell their government, we're not going to put up with this crap anymore. We are not going to sell pulp to Japan for a song just so three or four big companies in Australia can get massively rich. We're not going to bring that pulp back to Australia as paper to wrap up hamburgers in. We're going to conduct a different kind of forestry. It will not destroy our economy. It will improve employment rather than reduce it. And this is how we're going to run our country now, because we believe in looking after the earth. And if we don't learn from those horrific fires, it means that we do not give a stuff about our grandchildren and we don't care about the earth. I want a better world for my grandchildren than the one we have at present, not a worse one. And I'm not going to use the economy as an excuse to destroy the earth. I'm going to use the economy as an excuse to do things differently. Because if we follow that line of the far right are using, that we'd have to drive and drive and drive the earth to produce more and more and more for more and more people, we will destroy the capital asset, the only capital asset we have, and that's the earth.
Bruce, it's a challenge, but it's a thing that, as you say, should be keeping us busy. Hugely appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and appreciate all your works. Thank you so much.
Good on you, Jonathan, and happy Writers' Week.
That was Bruce Pascoe, author of Dark Emu, talking with me, Jonathan Green, on Radio National's Big Weekend of Books.